Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 4th of June. This hour, the question is, how smart should the president be? And another question, do the smartest presidents make the best presidents? And who were the smartest presidents in this country, and how do we determine how smart they were? I'll give you a little clue. Number one on the list, this guy's off the charts smart. I should make it a quiz, actually. Oh, I can't do that because I gotta tell you, it's John Quincy Adams. Number one, way off the charts. Our guest this hour is Professor David Hambrick. He wrote a very interesting article in Scientific American. He's a psychologist and a professor at Michigan State University who studies cognition and cognitive neuroscience. His research focuses on individual differences in intelligence and skill. He's also an associate editor of the Journal of Experimental Psychology. I just have a feeling that this is going to generate a lot of phone calls, Facebook messages, so let me give you our number. And would you answer this question? How smart should the president be? It's a good question. How smart? Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we are on Twitter as well. And that's @KDunnShow. Professor Hambrick, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hello, thanks for having me.
I think we're going to have some fun. I'm sure we're going to have some fun. There are three basic views you write in that Scientific American article between the relationship between IQ and success in the Oval Office. First is, and let's start with this, the smarter the president, the better.
Right. So the basic idea there is that the relationship between success in the Oval Office and intelligence goes in a straight line, so to speak, or in more statistical terms, it's linear. So the higher the level of intelligence, the better the predicted performance in the office.
Number two, you only have to be smart enough to be president.
Right. So this is the idea that intelligence is what we call a threshold variable. In his book, Outliers, Malcolm Gladwell talked about this idea and suggested that after an IQ of about 120, that it doesn't matter if you're any smarter for success in various realms. So this view predicts that the relationship between intelligence and success and being president is positive up to a point, but then it flattens out.
And what is the average IQ, Professor?
The average IQ in the general population is 100. So in the general population, 100.
Okay. And number three, which we have not forgotten, we remember number three, a president can actually be too smart, unable to communicate on a level that less intelligent colleagues and constituents can understand. Can you be too smart?
Well, this is the idea that there's sort of an optimal level of intelligence, and beyond that, intelligence is too much of a good thing, so to speak. So, as you say from the article, once a person is sort of into the well beyond kind of the genius range, they, for example, can no longer effectively communicate with their colleagues and constituents.
Do you know many geniuses? Maybe you are one. I don't know.
I think it all depends on how you define genius, and this is contested question. So one way is simply in terms of IQ, and most psychologists who study this thing sort of agree that, well, maybe that says something. You can do well on standardized tests, and you have a good vocabulary and good reasoning skills, but that's certainly not the only way to define genius, and I think we all can think of people in our lives who are exceedingly book smart, but maybe who haven't, whose accomplishments in the real world don't match their intellectual brilliance. So this is not an easy question to answer exactly what a genius is.
I liked the quote that you include from Gary Hart, and I think this is true. He argued that although a big part of success as president is picking smart people for key positions, which is true everywhere,
right,
it takes a keen mind honed by study, travel, experience, and exposure to competing ideas to form good judgment and to know who to trust on complex substantive issues. I think he's right.
I think he's right, too. So, the defenders of the idea that you only have to be too smart to be, you only have to be only so smart to be president, I don't think that they sort of factor this in, that you have to make complex judgments and decisions about who is best for a particular position. So you can surround yourself with smart people, but you have to be smart in order to do that. That's sort of what I think he was saying in that quotation, which I agree with.
There is a list of presidential IQs, highest to lowest estimated IQs. How do we find the IQs of all these presidents? I mean, John Quincy Adams didn't take an IQ test,
right,
did he?
No, that's a great question. So these IQ estimates are based on what's called a historiometric research approach. So in the kind of the traditional approach to measuring intelligence, you have somebody sit down and take an intelligence test, a standardized intelligence test that has tests that measure reasoning and comprehension and memory and so forth. Obviously, we can't do this with presidents. So we do know, on the other hand, we know we've identified variables that at least correlate with intelligence, like educational accomplishment and other sorts of accolades, writing a book, and so on. And so based on this information that we do have about presidents, we can estimate what their intelligence is, their IQ was. Now, these aren't exact estimates. Of course, there's some error, but there's also an error around an IQ score that you obtain from somebody sitting for an IQ test. So that's the basic approach we use. Historical information to estimate intelligence,
mm-hmm,
quantitatively using statistical techniques.
So this method, this historiometric method,
mm-hmm,
you say is based on variables that do have known correlations,
right,
with IQ.
That's right. Yes, that's exactly right.
Well, let's talk about John Quincy Adams for just a moment, because when you look at all the presidents, everybody's got a pretty good IQ, but this guy, 168.75, he's by far and away way, way at the top.
Well, yes, and that's interesting. So his exceedingly high IQ, he was precocious, and so as a child, and so that in part reflects that. I recently had a conversation with the author of the paper that I write about in this Scientific American article, and what he says is that if you look more at later life accomplishments, actually Jefferson is the highest, and so they're both very high. They were both very bright, but I think this raises an important point, and which again is that these are estimates, and so it somewhat depends on how you what information you use to estimate the IQs, who comes out on top. But certainly he was very bright.
And yet one of those presidents we don't pay a whole lot of attention to. There recently have been some books about John Quincy Adams, and he was a fascinating man.
Mm-hmm.
But we tend to center on other presidents, and people write about them endlessly.
Right. Jefferson being sort of the most obvious
mm-hmm.
case in point.
Wait, is your IQ, how old do you have to be to measure IQ, and does your IQ stay constant through your life or not?
Well, IQ tests have been developed for children, very young children, so 5 or 6 years old. And the answer to your question, whether it's stable, is yes, relatively speaking. It's among the most stable psychological traits that we know of. So there was research done in Scotland. A sample of people, when they were 11 years old, took an IQ test in school. Nearly the entire country on that given day, all of the school children took an IQ test. And the researchers there, a researcher named Ian Deary at the University of Edinburgh, tracked these people down over 60 years later and had them take an IQ test again. And what he found is that there was remarkable stability in the intelligence test scores across that very long period of time, over 60 years. It's not perfect stability, so there's some movement, but a person who did well at age 11 tended to do well at age 70 or so.
Oh, that's interesting. And, you know, I have no idea what my IQ is. Did I take an IQ test and I never got the results? Do we all take one at some point?
Well, anyone who has taken a college admissions test has taken what Howard Gardner, who proposed the theory of multiple intelligences, he aptly called a thinly disguised intelligence test. The SAT, the ACT. Scores on these tests correlate extremely highly with scores on standardized tests of intelligence. So if you ever took one of those tests, you basically have.
Oh, that's interesting. And when you talk about, and you're studying in this area and research in this area, general cognitive ability, the psychological trait underlying IQ, the single best predictor of performance in the workplace and as a president, I would imagine as well. What does that mean, general cognitive ability?
Well, it's we think of it as the ability to reason, solve novel problems, use memory, and to make good judgments. Those are sort of the defining characteristics of general cognitive ability.
And would you say that on the whole, as you look at all of these presidents, that if the IQ is within a certain range, your ability to have good cognitive ability is greater? I mean, if you're 125 or above, or do you just have to be at the 120 or the 118 or where?
Well, yeah, that's interesting. The results of this presidential study that I wrote about actually suggest that the higher the better. And this has been looked at in other domains as well, for example, work performance and academic performance. And the general finding is that despite this sort of popular notion that IQ loses its predictive validity beyond a certain point, in fact, the evidence suggests that it's the higher the better. Now, it could be the case that, and there is some evidence that for president getting elected, in fact, that there's this sort of optimal IQ, and that beyond that, having a really high IQ can actually be detrimental. But as far as success in the office is concerned, the evidence that we have, which is the study that I wrote about, suggests this sort of more is better hypothesis.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell from all of your studies in the area, Professor Hamburg, when somebody seems really smart, when somebody probably has a very high IQ?
Do you mean can you tell without looking at their
yes.
test scores? No, you really can't. Now, if you observe somebody making extremely bad choices, you might make some reasonable inferences, but it's really hard to tell without giving someone an assessment of cognitive ability where they'll turn out to be.
Do you think that as a matter, because we're in heavens knows, way before the election, a presidential campaign with more and more people deciding they're going to run every single day. Do you think we should know what their IQs are?
Well, I think that it's a good idea to try to make some guesses. I think we can't know, right? I mean, as Gary Hart said in his article, the Constitution doesn't require that people who want to run for president take an IQ test. But I think that it's a good idea to try to make some reasonable reasonable guesses.
Mm-hmm. We touched on this, but here's a Facebook comment from Jim who says that if you do have a very, very high IQ, you can become too detached and cerebral. A common criticism of Obama, similar to Woodrow Wilson, is often accompanied by a disdain for the backslapping that's often required in cajoling Congress.
Well, I think that's an interesting idea. But in fact, when we look at not getting elected, so where getting elected is concerned, he might be right. But if we look at the data that we have from the study that I wrote about, the results of that study are not consistent with what the listener is saying. Instead, what the data suggest is the higher the better. Now, is the correlation perfect? No, not by far. But it is significant. It's a correlation that's large enough that it we should pay attention to it.
We're going to go to phone calls. We have many of them coming in, and here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. Our guest wrote a very interesting piece that caught our attention in Scientific American. Our guest is a psychologist and professor at Michigan State University who studies cognition and cognitive neuroscience, Professor David Hambrick. The article is titled, How Smart Should the President Be? And that's the focus of our conversation. How do you answer that question? We'll be with you momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. How smart should the president be is the question of the hour. Betsy in River Falls, hi.
Hi, I'm not here to ask a question. I'm here to answer one. You asked how smart you were. Kathleen, after listening to you all these years and the incredibly good questions you ask and your insightfulness and your wisdom and your sense of humor, You're high in my book, and I've got an IQ of 133, so I know a smarty one I see one. So thank you.
Oh, Betsy, okay. What a wonderful phone call. Too self-serving, but I don't think I am all that smart. I think other people in my family are really smart. I mean, I'm curious, but I work very hard. I think that there's, and I wanted to ask you about that too, Professor Hambrick. There are people who have very high IQs who don't work very hard, and we all know some of them. And I'm wondering, you know, if there is also, there are studies that look at how hard somebody applies him or herself to a job, how hard you study, how much you practice the 10,000 hours idea to become successful at something. And maybe you're not all that smart. I don't know. I have no idea what my IQ is, and I never want to know. But I work at what I do.
Well, I think this is a really excellent point, and it goes back to the point that the correlation between IQ and success as president, or for any other sort of variable reflecting success for that matter, work performance, academic performance, the correlation is far from perfect, okay? So what that means is that intelligence is not the only factor that contributes to someone's success or lack thereof in a particular domain. So there are other factors that are critical, and one of them is how hard you work. The evidence, not surprisingly, just based on common observation, is completely consistent with this. So in the study of presidents, they also looked, in addition to intelligence, looked at personality factors. And one of the personality factors that comes out as another significant predictor of success in office is conscientiousness. This is a personality characteristic that in part reflects your dedication to your work. And so I think you're quite right that it's only one piece of the puzzle, intelligence is. It's an important piece, statistically speaking, practically speaking, theoretically speaking, but it's only one piece.
Right. Well, I believe, if my memory serves me correctly, that John Quincy Adams, I'm a little fixated on him this hour, could speak a number of languages.
Yeah.
I always equate people who can do that pretty effortlessly with being pretty smart. So it begs the question for me, there are some people who maybe don't have to work at it very hard, that you're so smart that it just comes fairly easily to you.
Well, I think that some people have to work less hard than others, but certainly when we're dealing with a job as demanding as president, where you have to master a vast array of different topics and or learn different topics and so on, I think that a strong work ethic is going to be critical, no matter how smart someone is. But yes, I think that it is the case that, you know, some people don't have to work as hard, for example, to learn a language. Now, we aren't born with this sort of knowledge. You know, everybody has to work at it to get something like to understand foreign policy or to learn another language. But
yes.
Sure, I mean, I think it's true that some people learn things more readily than others.
Mm-hmm. Well, Betsy, thank you so much. You, of course, are my favorite all-time caller. It was very nice of you. Luba in Madison, hi.
Hi there. I have a question. I think sometimes, most often, your ethical standards of the person regarding intelligence is more important, actually, than a very high IQ, and I admire Ralph Nader because I find him to be very ethical, very intelligent, and very knowledgeable. And yet he treads water. He cannot, he was successful in running for president. And also, I wanted to know the members of the relationship of memory and intelligence.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. Memory and intelligence.
Well, so on the first point, this is an example of another factor that is critical to consider in looking at the success of presidents that is not intelligence, right? So someone's ethical standards. And then on the second point, memory is an essential integral part of intelligence. So standardized intelligence tests, for example, include tests of several different types of memory, including the long-term memory and also what we call working memory. So working memory is being able to hold in mind some piece of information over a relatively short period of time. So memory is an essential part of intelligence.
Mm-hmm. And Brad on Facebook writes of yet another kind of intelligence. He says a better correlation would be between what he calls EQ and presidential success, how empathic a leader is, how humble, what their values are. So many have a questionable sense of morality, and he's not talking about adultery.
Right. So EQ is emotional intelligence and captures among other things, sort of interpersonal skills. And I'm not aware of any attempts to look at the relationship between EQ and success in the Oval Office, but he may well be right.
Thanks, Luba. Tim in New Berlin, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. And I think you're smart, too, by the way.
Thank you, Tim.
But let's think for a second about Robert McNamara. Everybody, he got us into Vietnam. He was the architect of Vietnam. They said you could not beat this guy in a debate. He was the smartest guy in the room, no matter who was there. So I think it's wrong to equate IQ with judgment. But mainly what I'm calling about is your guest's repeated reference to ACT and SAT being a direct reflection of IQ. I disagree with that. I think it is directly skewed for the rich. The ACT test, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's $75, and you can take it over and over again if you have money. And the preparation, I knew one young man, very smart, got a 32, which is very high on the ACT. His parents could afford 7 consecutive Saturdays of intensive drilling to teach the test so that he could do well on the ACT. Something tells me that in the inner city, those kids taking the ACT are walking in there, they're taking it one time, they have no preparation, and they're just hoping for the best. And I think that he is wrong to say that ACT and SAT directly reflect IQ when it's all skewed for the rich. And if he says, well, okay, but the IQ test says the same thing, then I would say the poor kids aren't prepared for that test either.
Thank you, Tim, for your call. Professor Hamburg.
This is a common criticism and a valid criticism of intelligence tests as well as the SAT and the ACT. People have looked at this, psychologists have looked at this extensively, and when you look at scores on the SAT and the ACT as predictors of success in college, they still predict success in college even after you take into account socioeconomic status. So it's not the case that a score on one of these college admissions tests is simply a stand-in for socioeconomic status. This has been looked at in very large samples, and it's there is a correlation between socioeconomic status and scores on these tests, but it is not especially large. And it more important when you control for socioeconomic status, these tests still have validity for predicting the outcomes that they're intended to predict, namely success in college. So this is, again, a valid point, but I think that what your listener is suggesting is that score on SAT or ACT is simply a stand-in for your for how rich you are, and that's not the case.
Thanks very much for the call, Tim. Matt is next in Sparta. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Anthony. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I had a slightly similar comment to the last caller. I know when I took my SAT and also my GRE, I studied, you know, pretty extensively for both of them. Shouldn't a true IQ test be something that cannot be studied for, something that measures raw cognitive ability as opposed to how much you know about what you learned in school?
That's an interesting question.
Well, yes, and this raises a really important point, and that is a distinction between what we call fluid intelligence and what we call crystallized intelligence. So fluid intelligence you might think of as sort of your raw intellectual horsepower. This is the ability to solve novel problems, adapt to new situations, and it's measured with tests where you aren't simply retrieving the answer from memory. For example, logic problems that you would have never seen before. Now, on the other hand, crystallized intelligence is knowledge that you acquire through experience, for example, reading or going to school. And crystallized intelligence can be increased through engaging in these in different learning activities, so studying. I think that this distinction is critical with respect to the point that the listener is making.
Let's go back to the presidents for a moment and the presidential IQs, highest to lowest. Were any of these of great surprise to you, and does everybody fall into a pretty good range, or are there some who are way down there?
Well, I have to confess, I was surprised that George W. Bush was as high as he is. He is not at the bottom, his estimated IQ was about 120, and I was surprised that he was that high. None of the others particularly surprised me, but his did.
Well, I remember that controversy. It's been a subject of conversation in our house. Who had the higher IQ, John Kerry or George W. Bush? And it was Bush, wasn't it?
George W. Bush did better on a standardized test that the military gives. It's the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery, and there's an IQ-like score that's derived from this test. And at least according to one report, Bush had a higher score than Kerry did. Although apparently Kerry's score report was kind of blurry. There wasn't a good copy of it, and so there was some controversy over that. But
it's hard to find the truth sometimes, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. And you were surprised that George Bush's was as high as it was because of his demeanor, because of the way he used language, or what?
Well, his demeanor and his disastrous decisions in office, in my opinion, made some very bad decisions, and so I was surprised that it was as high as it was.
On the other hand, you were not surprised by, we haven't talked about others in the top, we've talked about John Quincy Adams a lot, but and a little bit about Thomas Jefferson. Who are some of the others who were particularly bright?
John Kennedy, very high. Bill Clinton, very high. I think Bill Clinton was fifth overall. And that was quite consistent with sort of his accomplishments, academic accomplishments, also with him being a formidable debater and having a command of a vast range of topics and so on. So that was not particularly surprising either.
Mm-hmm. I remember once years ago, I was interviewing Gloria Steinem, and we knew we were going to have Clinton on for like a 15-minute interview, and two things. I mean, his just native intelligence. He had somebody call me the night before, this is an assistant to President Clinton. He just wanted to know a little bit about you before the interview. I almost dropped the phone. I thought, are you kidding me? You want to know about me? But then he was listening. They overlapped. Steinem and Clinton overlapped for about a minute period of time. And he picked right up on some obscure piece of legislation that she was talking about, and he knew everything about it. It was amazing to me.
Right, right. He's famous for this sort of thing, and he also, I think, is extremely high on what one of your earlier callers mentioned, and that is emotional intelligence. So this sort of ability to make you feel like you were the only person in the room when he was talking to you, and sort of a remarkable ability to connect with people.
Right. And a remarkable ability to not have common sense and realize you can get in serious trouble if you fool around with an intern, right?
Right. Well, that too.
Thanks very much, Matt, for your call. Marcus in Green Bay. Hi. Our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. In case you're just tuning us in, the question of the hour is, how smart should the president be? And we have a ranking of how smart the presidents are, too. Marcus in Green Bay. Hi.
Hello. Since I talked to the screener, you mentioned one of the presidents, so maybe you guys can help me frame this question right or whatever. So we talked about IQ is a written test, and there's other factors that play into intelligence. You mentioned traveling, and et cetera. So I'd like to know how much it plays into it. And you know, we don't know the president's medical records or anything, but maybe looking back in history, and I'll just mention George Bush, and I'm not anti-Bush or anti-anybody, but how much does it play into also, like, when we think of obsessive-compulsive disorder or attention deficit disorder, the general public sort of sees it as a weakness or whatever, but eventually if the person fine-tunes that, it can become quite a bit of strength, adding to your intelligence. Looking back in history, you know, have you ever heard any? And first of all, how does that play into intelligence? What, how much? And then, are there any presidents that, looking back, may have had this and it added or took away? And then, I guess I'll just say one quick thing is, I remember as far as intelligence, and I'm not knocking Bush, but when the plane crashed into the World Trade, and he was in front of the classroom, and he was notified, I felt so sorry for the guy because, how, you know, intelligence also, you know, being able to react, being able to carry on a conversation or even a debate, you know, where it's, where your reaction is quick, you know, you can right. find the answer in your mind. And so please discuss this if you
okay.
would.
Okay. Thank you, Marcus.
Well, one thing that I think an interesting point there is sort of I think part of this conscientiousness factor that predicts also predicts success in the Oval Office is attention to detail, and in the extreme, attention to detail could take on characteristics of obsessive compulsive disorder, and this is a very limited sort of piece of information about this, but Jimmy Carter supposedly was a micromanager, very smart, so he's also one of the highest in terms of estimated IQ, but legend has it that he wanted himself to take care of scheduling the White House tennis courts.
Oh, did he really?
That's what I've heard. It could be apocryphal. But that would be sort of an example of what your caller is talking about there.
Thank you, Marcus. You mentioned tennis courts, which I don't know why chess came to mind. But I rewatched the West Wing series a few weeks ago, and President Bartlet was always playing chess with people and sort of a test of how smart they were, if they could beat him. Are there certain games that we play, chess being maybe at the top, that will show our IQ?
Right. Chess would be one example. There's evidence, not surprisingly, perhaps, that the person's skill in chess correlates with intelligence. I'm not aware of many other studies that have looked at, you know, correlations between IQ and, say, the ability to play complex video games, but I suspect those correlations are there just by virtue of their sort of cognitive complexity. Scrabble, actually, is one that has been looked at. And people who are champion Scrabble players or experts at Scrabble have score high on tests of certain types of reasoning ability and also what we call working memory. Again, this is the ability to hold in mind some information over a short period of time. So there is evidence, at least for some games, to support what you're saying there.
More phone calls in a moment. Professor David Hambrick is our guest. He's a psychologist. He's a professor at Michigan State University, and he studies cognition and cognitive neuroscience. This piece that he wrote, we thought, is a natural for a talk show, and I think we were right. It's really interesting. How smart should the president be, and do the smartest presidents make the best presidents? As we go through the lengthy process of presidential campaigning, should we be looking at how smart all these candidates are? Is that a factor that you consider when you're deciding who to vote for? Do you look at how smart somebody is? And also the interesting part of the article, I love the rankings, presidential IQs, highest to lowest. Obviously, not everybody took an IQ test, so he described earlier in the show what it is that they're looking at in terms of academic success, test scores, et cetera, accomplishments in office, that would have these historical figures ranked. Number one, John Quincy Adams. The last one on this sheet is Buchanan. Our number, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. You know we'd love presidential history on this show, too. So go to our Facebook page and write your comments. Who do you think was the smartest president? And is there a difference between how effective a president is and how smart a president is? We'd like to hear your thoughts. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Paul in Madison. Hi. Paul.
Yeah. Hi. Professor Hambrick. My question is, well, you mentioned the study in, was it Scotland or the UK, where they tested kids when they were 11 and again when they were around 70, and IQ is basically constant. My question is, are there things that can either lower, it's almost two questions, are there things that can either lower or raise, actually raise your IQ? And I'm thinking of things along the lines of, I don't know, alcohol use or pathologies, I suppose, for lowering IQ, and as far as raising it, mental exercises, LSD.
Well, right. This is a great question. So back to the study in Scotland. So the correlation between IQ scores at age 11 and in, I think it was age 77, it was high, but it was not perfect. So it was as high as we see for any psychological trait. But some people did move around. What that means is some people got lower and some people got higher relative to other people. And there are many possible reasons for this. So someone could get lower because of a concussion or repeated concussions. Or prolonged alcohol or drug use. Someone could get higher because they, you know, immersed themselves in school or something having to do with the nature of the work that they did. So the short answer to your question is yes. I mean, there are certainly factors that could lower someone's IQ and factors that could raise it. It was not constant. In the Scotland study, the scores across time weren't constant. They were relatively stable, not perfectly stable.
So do you think this whole industry, how to improve your memory in 30 days, we've done shows on that, to make your brain muscle stronger, is that a sham or is there something to it?
Well, this has been, I've done research on brain training and its effectiveness, and what the available research shows is that brain training games like Lumosity, as an example, you get better at the brain training game, but there's no compelling evidence for transfer to real-world activities and skills and tasks. So I don't think that many of these brain training, commercially marketed brain training programs work as certainly suggested. You get better at the brain training task itself, but who cares, right?
Right. You really want a stronger brain. That's the
right.
Point of the whole thing. Thank you, Paul, for the call. Mike in Glendale is next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I just was thinking, as I was listening to the discussion about what characteristics in terms of how smart you want a president to be, that, you know, don't you actually kind of want kind of someone who's smart as well as a good leader? Because, you know, you could be a very intelligent person, as I think Professor Indy was, but not necessarily a someone who could get people who were maybe opposed to them or who thought that a different course of action was a better course of action to get them behind the direction that they wanted people to go. And then by the converse of that is you could get people who aren't very smart who could get people behind them who, if they were great leaders, they can get people behind them, but they've got a really bad idea that is not very well thought out.
Right. I think that's a great point. So all else equal, I think we should want the president to be as smart as possible, but of course we know that all else isn't equal, so we have to take into account these other factors too. So yes, excellent point.
Thanks, Mike, so much for your call. Ron in La Crosse, hi.
Yes, of course, question is, I hope you didn't confuse the two Bushes, that maybe when you said George W, that maybe you were confusing him with his father. The other question is, what tests do they use to formulate someone's IQ, and really, what's that got to do with, say, leadership qualities like integrity? I understand Richard Nixon had a very high IQ, one of the highest, and yet, you know, he got himself into such a mess with this Watergate scandal cover-up. So, and I don't think IQ has anything to do with wisdom, necessarily, or even statecraft.
Well, the sorts of tests, there are many standardized tests of intelligence. These weren't used in this study of presidents. These presidential IQs were estimated based on historical information. And as far as the point about wisdom, I agree. And so this returns to sort of the theme that's been developing, and that is that sort of intellectual brilliance is only one factor here. But we do know that intelligence tests measure, we do know that they predict success not only apparently in the office of president, but in virtually any occupation. Now, do they predict all aspects of performance in a job? No. But they certainly do predict some key ones.
Professor Hambrick, do we know President Obama's IQ?
No, we don't. This sort of historiometric analysis has not been done with him included in the sample, but that's something that we'll be doing fairly soon.
And will you do that for everybody who's running for office?
Perhaps. I hadn't thought about that, but maybe I will.
Okay. Ron, thanks for the call. And we have time for one more call. Matt in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
All right, Matt. You?
Good. I'm fascinated by your idea of memory and how it serves intelligence. My dad had an astonishing memory, particularly his ability to go from short-term to long-term memory. He was a doctor. His entire medical notebook was about 50 pages long. And his comment was, well, if you're interested, you remember it, right? I'm like, no, regular people don't. And he used to always say that most doctors were very, very smart. Not very many of them were very good human beings. And that's the ones he hired and wanted to work with. And that's what I think we need to focus on is if you're looking at a politician, smart's one thing, a decent human being's another. Like the man was saying, Nixon was an incompetent human being as far as I can tell. And I'm wondering, is memory a significant component of your way of looking at intelligence?
Yes. In fact, that's been one major focus of my research that I've done over the years with colleagues is looking at the role of memory in intelligence, and it certainly is an important point. It sounds like your father had an exceptional working memory, so he was able to hold in mind information and then integrate it into his long-term memory knowledge structures, his pre-existing knowledge of medicine. So we've looked at memory in that way as a critical component of intelligence.
Thanks, Matt, so much for your call. Well, as I thought, it's been a very interesting hour, Professor Hambrick. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And we'll look forward to your assessment of the IQs of all the 200 people who are running for president. David Hambrick, he has a piece in Scientific American, and I believe it's on our Facebook page. You may find it of great interest. We did, and that's why we did the show. He's a psychologist, professor at Michigan State University, studies cognition, cognitive neuroscience, his research on individual differences in intelligence and skill. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this interesting hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we will return and talk about